workshop on premarital counseling. Okay, what we're going to be talking about in this hour, is essentially what we call preventive counseling as opposed to corrective counseling. Namely, that we are trying to, in the objectives of premarital counseling, we're trying to head off at the pass, so to speak, problems before they actually occur. And I might just explain a little bit about how we came into a premarital counseling program at Fairhaven, just to give you an idea of the background. Initially, we had a dichotomy within the eldership in terms of the way we handled people who were about to get married. For example, if Gene would marry someone, he really didn't have the time to give them more than about one session of counseling before marriage. When people began to ask me to marry them, I would say, great, I would love to do that. I really value the privilege, but I have a personal conviction that I should be, I have a personal conviction that I really should be involved with you on a counseling basis for about five sessions prior to marriage. And so people who wanted counseling might come to me. On the other hand, people who didn't want counseling might go to Gene. And in the meantime, we found that all of the elders were increasingly plagued with marriages that were breaking up. And usually, when the elders were called into a situation like that for counsel, it was too late. I mean, it was already a raging forest fire. You know, there was not a whole lot that we could really do at that particular time. And so the elders as a body became very concerned about this, and because I was already doing it with the couples that I was marrying, the other elders said, well, look, Mark, would you mind taking everybody who gets married through your program, even though they're married by Gene or Jack or whoever, in our eldership? And we agreed to do that. We were small enough then that we could do that, my wife and I, as a team. There weren't that many during the year, although it did keep us pretty busy to go through that procedure. And we developed a program for that. Most of the whole emphasis was with the idea of teaching couples enough about marriage that they could anticipate problems. And also, I must say, lowering their expectations of marriage. Because a lot of times people go into marriage with really high expectations, thinking that it's going to be a bed of roses and, you know, cloud nine for the rest of eternity with the girl of your dreams. And then you find out, as Gene says, she's a lemon in the garden of love, you know. And things are not quite what they're cracked up to be, and you're due for a letdown. And one of our objectives was to bring people down to reality, so they're not terribly disappointed in that whole process. It is amazing to me, and still continues to amaze me, how little many couples know about some of the basics of just care and concern of each other. I'm reminded of a couple that were seemed to be doing quite well for about 3 years. And very gradually, the wife began to cry more and more, and it got so bad that pretty soon she was just crying uncontrollably all the time, and she didn't seem to communicate very well. She seemed to be preoccupied with other things, and finally the fellow thought that he better take her to a counselor. So they went to a Christian psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist did all kinds of things to get to the root of her problem. He went through ink blots and all kinds of weird things to try and get at it, and after about 8 or 9 sessions, they were just getting no place. And finally, on about the 10th session, the psychiatrist thought he finally knew what was going on. So he got up from his desk and he went around to the front where Mrs. Jones was sitting, and he bent over and he just kissed her with a big smack right on the face. And all of a sudden, she stopped crying. She'd been weeping there in his office. She stopped crying. She lit up. She looked over to her husband and said, hey, what are we doing here? You know, let's go out and do something this afternoon.
just completely changed in composure. And all the time her husband is standing here and saying, you know, what is going on here? You know. And the counselor said, would you come into the other room with me, Mr. Jones? And he took him into the other room and he said, now, Mr. Jones, you see what has happened here today. He said, I am convinced that your wife needs this kind of treatment 7 days a week. He said, well, I think I can get her in here Monday through Friday, but I don't know about Saturday and Sunday. You know, see, well, a lot of times people come to us thinking that the counselor is going to do it when actually they need to exercise a little bit of that TLC, tender loving care, themselves. A lot of our counseling program is designed to do this. Now, the results have been quite gratifying. Through the years, we have, actually the numbers are a little higher than this, and I just haven't had the time to put together a transparency that gives this. We've taken about 83 couples now through premarital counseling, but since I have this transparency, let's stick with the 66. The percentages are about the same. And of the 66, 53 were married by an elder. In other words, of that 66, you had 13, which are summarized down here at the bottom, that did not get married. Of the people, at least we started with premarital counseling. Of those 66, we didn't take them all the way through. But 8 of those decided not to marry after the first session, on their own, not by our counsel, decided not to marry on their own after the first session. And we'll explain why that is in a minute when we tell you what we do in the first session. 5 of those were counseled not to get married. Okay, now there could be a number of reasons for that. We very seldom do that. As you can see here from the ratio, there's only 7.6%. 5 were counseled not to get married. In one case, because we weren't really convinced that the fellow was a Christian. He professed to be a Christian. And one of the assignments we gave them was for the fellow to get into a discipling relationship with another believer. And, of course, one of our motivations for that was not only to either do one of two things, to either get him moving for the Lord so we could be sure, or to reveal his true colors. And unfortunately, we revealed his true colors. He was not a Christian. As a result, that couple left our fellowship, got married anyway, and are now divorced. As a matter of fact, of the 5 that were counseled not to get married, 2 went ahead anyway, and both of those marriages have failed in divorce. Now, the 53 that were eventually married by an elder, 1 we have lost, unfortunately. We knew it was a problem marriage from the very beginning. We tried to delay it. We counseled a delay of 6 months. Get to know each other better. We went over the problems with them individually. My wife and I do team counseling together. She got with the wife and she said, are you sure you know what you're doing here? You know his problems. You really love him enough that you're willing to live with this problem for the rest of your lives, even if it gets worse. That's what we always say to him, because, you know, even though God's in the business of changing people, when you start living with a person round the clock, things may actually get better and you think they're getting worse because they tend to grind on you, you know. Well, that's what happened to this gal. And it turned out that this particular fellow, if you'll pardon the expression, had diarrhea of the mouth. He was just a constant talker. And she got eventually was irritated by that so much she just said, I have to get out, you know. And in spite of our counsel, in spite of our trying to work with them, she refused counsel. He wanted to pull it back together and she filed for divorce and left the fellowship.
Excuse me, Mark. Yep. You would not, obviously, the policy is not to marry a person who is a known Christian to an unknown Christian.
Right. We do not participate in unequal yokes.
Now, that's an absolute rule.
Right, that's an absolute rule. All of the elders have that personal conviction. Now, what we have done in the past is, for example, if we have a family in the fellowship who are Christians, and in one case I'm thinking of, they had a son who was not a Christian. In fact, he essentially was in his late teens when they came to the Lord, and he wanted nothing to do with Christianity. he found a young lady to marry, and the parents approached us and said, "Would you marry our son?" Now, it turns out he was also marrying a non-Christian, so there was no unequal yoke. We did not marry them in the chapel. We married them in their home. One of our elders did this as a courtesy to the parents. But again, it was not an unequal yoke, you see, that kind of thing. So, but you're right. We have that policy. In fact, the policy as it stands now is, let's see, maybe we ought to turn to this section, section 9 of your notes. The policy that we have for premarital counseling is outlined on page 9.4 of your notes. It is our premarital counseling program. And you will notice, if you read that, that we have a six-month requirement. In other words, a couple must come to us 6 months before they plan to get married, inform the elders, and be willing to submit themselves to this premarital counseling program in order to be married by an elder at Fairhaven. Now, we have no objection if we have a couple who wants to get married elsewhere. And in fact, if they don't want to go through our premarital counseling program, fine, you can go down the street and get married at the Presbyterian Church, wherever you want to do that. Of course, there is pressure from their peers, from their friends, to be married at Fairhaven. There is some of that. But we don't adopt a policy that, look, if you don't go through our premarital counseling program, we're going to excommunicate you or anything like that, or reject you at the door, any more than we would reject a couple that are Christians who come in right off the street freshly married. We're not going to reject that, so why should we reject our own people? All we're saying as elders is, look, we don't feel that our function is like the priest in the Catholic Church to perform ceremonies. We believe that our function is the pastoral care of our people. And if we find one of our people is going to get married, we feel like we ought to do more than just perform a ceremony. If we're going to be involved in that thing, we want to do everything possible to prepare them in the best way possible for marriage. Otherwise, we're just asking for trouble. We're tying a knot which is going to come unraveled later on, see? So what we're trying to do is preventive counseling to ensure the success of that marriage as much as we can. I think we learned from the one we lost. I think probably we would have, if we had done that today, we would have refused to marry that couple because it was clear they were headed for trouble. But we will insist on that if it's a marriage at our chapel where one of the elders is involved. And so we try to adhere to that policy as firmly as we can. Now, as time progressed, the chapel grew, the number of people wanting to be married increased. It became increasingly obvious to my wife and I that we would either have to go full-time into this ministry alone, or else we're going to have to get some help. So there's one of two ways you can do that. Many of you are probably in assemblies where you're small enough you don't have to worry about this problem, so I'll be brief about this. But if you are getting large, you can start training other people to join with you in this ministry, and you can go one of two roads. You can either have every person take one couple and take them through from beginning to end. The advantage of that is that sometimes a couple will open up in like the third session as they get to know you and trust you, whereas they might not in one session. The procedure we have elected is the one that's indicated on the first page of your notes, 9.1, the schedule, four sessions. You'll notice that my wife and I do the first session, but then the couple moves to another couple, and then another, until they go through five sessions plus one with whichever elder is going to marry them, the elder of their choice. And so this way we have a round robin. The advantage of this system to us is that, first of all, it acquaints that couple with five couples, key couples in our assembly that have their marriage together, are marriages that are centered around the Lord Jesus Christ. They get into their home, and one of the goals of our premarital counseling program is that the couple get to know at least one of these couples well enough, with enough rapport, so that after they get married, if there's some little problem that comes up, they'll feel free to call that person. You know, we had an argument tonight, you know, and she wants this and I want that. You know, how would you advise that we take care of that? See, a lot easier to put out a little spark like that at the beginning than try and put out a raging forest fire. See? And by the way, that's the reason that it turns out through the years, Fairhaven has now developed a reputation because of this program. It's having probably the best premarital counseling program in the East Bay around San Francisco. So we get a lot of people coming from the churches to us saying, look, we hear you have this premarital counseling program. Will you take us through it? Well, our response to them is, first of all, what do you have in your own church? Because if your pastor or your elders offer anything at all, we strongly recommend that you go through it with them so you get to know them, so that after you get married, if you're going to stay in fellowship with that church, you'll feel free to contact them if you have a little problem. See? So we're somewhat reluctant to take people on the outside through our program, just as a service to the general community. Now, that's not the only approach. In fact, there is one church in the San Francisco Bay Area that it's a Presbyterian church. They have a very fine premarital counseling program. They're on the other side of the bay from us. In fact, I was one of the couples in our church. Their parents went there, and they wanted me to marry them in that church. It turns out everybody wants to be married in that church. It is a beautiful church. It's up on the hillside in a wooded area. And the back, if you can imagine it, the back of the church is glassed in, looking out on a forest glade, you know. It's just a beautiful setting for a church. So all the non-Christians want to be married there, see, as well as their own church. And so they have a premarital counseling program. Interestingly enough, we found out also 6 months, same as ours. In fact, their pastor called me up and said, I understand you're going to be marrying this couple in our church, and I just want to check to see. I understand you have a premarital counseling program. I want to check to see if it fulfills our requirements. See, which is great. Really appreciated that. And as we compared notes, I asked him about his program, and he said, well, we marry a lot of non-Christians. He said, we would never marry a Christian to a non-Christian because of what the Scriptures say, but we do marry a lot of non-Christians. And I said, well, that's very interesting. He said, well, we have a lot of call here in the church. And he said, this, we feel, is one of our primary outreaches to the community, evangelistic outreach. We bring them in for 6 sessions of premarital counseling, and in each session we share Christ as the most solid foundation for a good marriage, share the biblical principles with them as we go through, and pray that they will come to the Lord. Now, this was such a revolutionary concept to me at the time. I was a little bit unnerved and didn't have my wits about me, or I would have asked, what happens if one of them comes to the Lord and the other one does not? You know, it could be a problem. A little embarrassing at the end there. But anyway, could be an outreach for you. Could be an outreach. If people are requesting to be married at your chapel. Well, I think it's a nice approach. And, you know, I can just imagine, see, what if that couple, as non-Christians, get into problems later on in their marriage? See, if they've had biblically-based premarital counseling, I'm sure the first thought that will occur to them as they get into those problems, you know, there is a missing ingredient in our marriage, namely Christ, see, from the counseling we've had, see. So I can see where you are planting the seeds for future fruit in that approach. So I don't think that's a bad approach. We haven't adopted it, but I throw it out for your consideration. Another advantage of this round robin that you see here outlined on pages 9.1 and 9.2 is the fact that some of our young people who have come to the Lord come from really wretched families. And whenever we get through the whole session, you'll notice the last thing on page 9.2 is an evaluation that occurs about 6 months after the marriage. It's a follow-up session. And one of the things that some of those couples have said to us is when we ask them the question, what was the most valuable thing to you about the premarital counseling program, some of them have said the most valuable thing was getting in 5 Christian homes where the marriages are working, where people don't constantly scream at each other and argue with each other over the dinner table. Oftentimes we'll invite them out for dinner to have these sessions. And where the atmosphere in that home is so different than what we could experience. It just completely changed our mindset of what a marriage could be. See? So that's another advantage of this system. Still a third advantage is the fact that what I have done is I've taken each of these couples that work with me and I've said, look, I want you to be a specialist in your area. Like in the second one, finances and budgeting. I tell Jack, look, you are the expert in our assembly on this area. I want you to read everything there is from a Christian perspective. If you see any new stuff, you be prepared to change this. Let's talk about it. Let's throw out the old stuff. Let's improve it. So we're constantly in evolution as we try to improve and upgrade our program as new materials become available. Now, I wouldn't say that all of these people are doing as well as others in that process of keeping up to date, but it's an attempt in that direction. Initially, you see, each of these couples took the materials that my wife and I had developed and they used them as a starting ground. And what we did initially is we took each of these couples and we said, we had an overall session and we were launching this program. We explained what we did overall. And then the session that they were responsible for, the next couple that went through, we had them sit in with us to see how we did that session with them. And then the third couple that went through, we had them handle it, but we sat in just to observe. So we broke them in gradually to the process, and now it's their own thing. And particularly the fourth session with Dean and Gloria Gossett, they've done a lot in terms of revision on their session. And in fact, a year ago, the two of them went away for a couple of days alone and just spent the whole time thinking through, praying through what they were doing with the couples and came up with a number of very valuable revisions. Not all of our couples have done that well. Any questions on the whole general program before I get into some of the details? Any? Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you counsel them in groups at all? Like you said, it's three couples of advisors, counselors. Do you do group counseling?
We have not.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Good. Yeah, that's right, because we don't have a pickup. The question was related, do we ever counsel in groups rather than as individuals? The program that you see outlined here in the manual is always with the individual. I don't feel you really get down to personal problems and difficulties in groups, and so it's necessary to do it individually. But I think you raise an excellent point. There is an advantage also in groups, and we have very frankly been considering doing one group session maybe once a quarter, say, for all the people involved in premarital counseling right then. Because there's a certain amount of value of interacting with your peers who are facing the same situation, see, of getting married, and being able to learn from each other. Now, what we have done is we have held some follow-up sessions with groups, which have been very beneficial, where we've had all the couples who've been married, say, in the last year get together. We did that one New Year's Eve. You know, and just review and share candidly what their problems were, what are the things that they expected, and what things were surprises to them, and have offered some help at that time. You know, in fact, one of the common things that came up then is people were disappointed that they had not been able to share Scripture with each other and pray together like they thought. And that's one of the reasons we developed that little system that is buried in your notes in the small group fellowships, highlight sharing, which my wife and I have used and has been very beneficial to share with them on that. But that's a good question. There was another hand over here.
You said that you like to delay the marriage for 6 months during counseling.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 31, I think, things numbered here
mm-hmm.
in these various people. Is that 31 weeks?
No. No, what each of these sessions usually takes, like Roman numeral 1 is the first session. Roman numeral 2 includes the items 1 through 3 as an assignment for that session. And that will take, usually each of these sessions will take place one per month. See, so that you get through about 5 or 6 in about a 6-month period. We like to spread them out so
so they have time to do the assignments, read the books, listen to the tapes, and all that kind of thing. See, so it's usually spread out over that period. Occasionally when we have maybe a fellow who's going to marry a girl that's from a piece away, we still like to insist on the premarital counseling. So one of the things that may happen is she may fly in to our area for maybe 2 or 3 weekends during that period. And in that specific special case, we may combine, you know, 2 or 3 sessions in the same weekend. You know, giving them the materials ahead of time, making sure they did the assignments and that kind of thing, just to facilitate things for them. It's not the ideal, but it's a way of trying to get around the geographical problem. Okay, yeah.
She supplied the books?
The books are usually their responsibility to purchase. The only exception to that is the very last session, we used to have a book by Tim LaHaye called The Act of Marriage, which covers the physical relationship in marriage, the sexual relationship in marriage. We do have in that session some tapes by Dr. Ed Wheat, who is a Christian medical doctor that talks about sex technique. How many of you are familiar with those tapes, by the way? Okay, good. So they are available here in Australia. Excellent set of tapes, particularly for those of us who are a little embarrassed about talking about this subject with a couple. The couple running that session, Bill and Shirley, said, look, we think the couple needs something that they can refer to and take with them on their honeymoon. So they recommended this book, The Act of Marriage, and we had that as an assignment. You'll notice it's not on the sheet now. And the reason was that that's a pretty heavy session anyway. And the second reason was that we felt we were pounding them with too much stuff on the sexual area. And some of them were overwhelmed, you know, really very protected. We do leave that to the very last session because we don't want to get people thinking too much about this too far in advance. But then again, if you really pound them with a lot of stuff in this area, we're probably doing a disservice and they probably don't even know what they're reading. So what we've done now is Bill and Shirley have said, look, we're going to cut out the book, but we will give it to them as a wedding gift. So they have it to go with them on their honeymoon, see? So with the exception of that book, all of the other books, they're responsible to either borrow from another couple in the fellowship or to purchase themselves. We recommend purchase because we think a lot of them are good reference books. The tapes, we usually lend them. The worksheets, we give to them. And by the way, unless you see a copyright on some of these, you will on a few, in your notes here, you are welcome, as far as we're concerned, to copy anything we've done. We'd probably like a little credit to Fairhaven Bible Chapel, unless you change it quite a bit, and then you can make it your own. But you're welcome to use anything that's in your notebook here, unless it has a copyright from another source. The first program we do serves the same purpose in the first session, but I understand the training is not available here in Australia, and that is the use of the Taylor-Johnson temperament analysis. Is anybody aware of that or familiar with that at all? Okay, you are. Did you get the training here?
No, I just transformed my counselor.
Is there training available in Australia for this? There is. Do you know who offers it? Uh-huh. Okay. Because in Brisbane, no one knew of where to get training on this.
Who?
Bill
Khan, a counseling center
in Victoria.
Okay. Does anyone have the address of that?
Yes, Marysville.
That's where you will? Okay. It would be very helpful to some of the brethren in Brisbane if we could send them that address on where they could get that training. Yeah. Okay. Apparently they weren't in our seminar, so. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right.
Who was the liaison in Brisbane for you on
this? Don Adams.
Don Adams.
Yeah.
If
you. No. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me just explain a little bit about this test. It kind of serves the same purpose that Graham was mentioning of the other purpose. This is a temperament analysis that looks at 9 different character traits. It's not a particularly Christian test at all. These were secular psychologists who put this together. But the interesting thing about it is that the
nine character traits that it measures have a rough correspondence with the nine fruits of the Spirit, interestingly enough. They pick nine character traits that are a good measure of interpersonal relationships. And like this first one, they're measured in opposites here. Nervous.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
Interestingly enough, they pick nine character traits that are a good measure of interpersonal relationships. And like this first one, they're measured in opposites here. Nervous versus composed. The definitions are down here. Obviously, composed is equivalent to the fruit of peace. Depressive versus lighthearted is equivalent to the fruit of joy. See, and all the way through to the last one, self-discipline, which is equivalent to the fruit of self-control. And there is, my wife and I have presented some marriage seminars based on this test where we have everybody at the retreat or the couples conference take this test in advance. We grade it, redistribute the test to them, and then talk about each of the traits. And the sheet that we hand out with that session is on page 9.6 and 9.7. It's the correlation between the Taylor-Johnson temperament analysis and the fruits of the Spirit with various scriptures that we use in working with people to help improve their trait. Now, the psychologists have said, look, there are optimum areas to be on this chart. The closer you are to one side, the closer you are to that trait on a percentile basis. And the darkest area is excellent. The next shading is acceptable, and then improvement desirable. If it's in the white area, improvement urgent. And what we do is we look at that profile and discuss with them their strengths and their weaknesses. By the way, we have the test, we have the couple do the test two different ways. We have them do it on themselves and then on their fiancé. And what we then get is a crisscross. Like here, the solid line is what the husband did on himself. The dashed blue line is what the wife did on him. And the discrepancy shows us how well the couple knows each other. As we discuss with them and explore this, if it's really a bad match in terms of knowing each other, as we discuss with them, if it's clear that they don't know each other, we may recommend a postponement, even beyond the 6 months, see? We may say, look, why don't you take the next 6 months and just get to know each other? I mean, after all, you're entering into a contract for the rest of your lives. Don't you think it's worth 6 months just to get to know each other? See? So we might give them some communication exercises and things like that. This particular couple was a married couple, but then here was the one on the wife, the same thing in the reverse direction. By the way, when you take the test on the Lord Jesus Himself, when you answer the questions on the test on the Lord Jesus, He does come out a perfect profile on this test, okay, in terms of interpersonal relationships. My wife has also done it on Moses, on Saul, on David. Really interesting to go through this and analyze Bible characters. In fact, there's some Bible study groups in Southern California that are using the test for that purpose. And then we compare their individual profiles. The man is in red, the wife is in blue, and we look for a match in terms of marriage compatibility factors. For example, in this couple, they've got a real problem here in the active social quiet area. The reason that's a real problem is that you've got the wife here always wanting to do things. Let's have the Joneses over for dinner. Let's go out to a movie. Let's go bowling. Let's do this. At the same time, we got the husband saying, man, I'm tired from work. Just leave me alone. I want to curl up tonight with a good book. I want to sit down in front of the TV. And so we've got this constant discrepancy. Pretty soon, the wife is saying, look, do you mind if I go out with the gals and go bowling? Oh, no, I'm delighted to be at home alone. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have friends outside of marriage, but you see what happens is the marriage starts moving apart. They stop doing things together. Pretty soon you've got two people living in the same house with no common interests. So there's a problem there. We also find this couple doesn't have much of a problem, but we also find that where both of the couples are very, very subjective, that there can be a real problem. That is the biggest headache, when they are both subjective. That means they're very emotional. They're not rational. If the other person says something to them, it may be just a question. They may interpret it as an attack. You know, we've seen a little of this in our own marriage. You know, my wife has a famous story she tells couples to illustrate this point. She says, you know, Mark used to come home and he would yell down from upstairs, "Dear, where's the checkbook?" And she said, I would jump to the conclusion that he was accusing me of losing the checkbook. See, really all I was doing was just trying to find it, you know. Well, we have a little joke about this. We say, look, when you're that subjective, there's no way that you can go to a rugby match or a football game, because when the team meets in the huddle, you'll always be afraid they're talking about you. See? Well, yeah, it's almost paranoia, see, when you get to that stage. And there are other things here that, I mean, obviously you don't want both people hostile. You don't want both people dominant. That spells competition. And furthermore, from a biblical standpoint, we say we want the man dominant. This is a role reversal situation here, see. So we look, I won't belabor this because not many of you have experience with it, but it's a beautiful tool in terms of discovering what the problems are going to be in the marriage. And then what we do is we fill out a report form based on this, which is included on page 9.16. Gives all the facts, years they've been Christians, tentative marriage, day, time, engaged, years known each other, and then the basic problem this couple will have, as revealed on the Taylor Johnson. And we need to help this couple in this. This goes ahead to the next counseling couple. When they complete their session, they fill out the form on 9:14 and 9:15, which essentially says, from your session, do you agree with the Taylor-Johnson temperament analysis? Do you feel you were able to help with this problem? See? And so forth down the line. And then the last few questions are particularly crucial because it says, do you feel comfortable with their tentative marriage date, or do you recommend postponement? We reserve the right at any given point to blow the whistle on the marriage. And say, look, delay, call it off, call back all the wedding announcements. Sometimes it gets a little embarrassing. We've never done it at the 11th hour, although I have a friend in Colorado who did do that after the sixth session that he had. And the couple was really broken up about it because he went right over to the inn and called them up and said, in good conscience, I just don't think I can perform this marriage. But that girl today is thanking him and works for him in his business. And she told me, she said, that's the greatest thing anyone ever did for me, because I could see right now that marriage would just been a catastrophe. See? So we reserve the right to do that. But one of the things these reports do is they keep coming back to me. I read them. That way I coordinate. I know where the couple is. The next couple in line has the benefit of what I have already covered in my session, at least in summary. And by the time they get to the last couple, they've got a big sheaf of reports so that that couple is not beginning from scratch. See, it's an attempt to get around this problem of they don't start spilling the beans till the third session, you know. They're not confident with you. They don't trust you. We tell them in advance, we say, look, we're not going to pass your profile around. We feel that the details of this are confidential. But with your permission, we will at least outline on a sheet of paper what we feel are the basic problems so that succeeding couples can work on those problems with you. And most of them really appreciate that. Now, we've had a few, like you mentioned, Graham, who seem they're doing it just to get by. But I must say that these days, probably in the last year, I'd say 9 out of 10 couples have gone the second mile. They come back and say, look, can you give us anything else to do? Is there anything else we could do here? Can you tell us more about how to do better in this area? You know, they're just really trying to wring this thing for the last ounce of what they can get out of it. And that's really, really reassuring in trying to get across. Okay, any questions on the Taylor-Johnson? Yeah.
Sorry, it wasn't on that, but I was...
Well, anything. That's all right.
Do you find couples after they've gone through this course, perhaps approaching marriage, feeling that things are going to work automatically?
No, the question is, do you find couples, because of the course, feeling like they've got the world by the tail, I guess, if you know that expression, and like nothing can faze them and it's going to be a perfect marriage? No, as a matter of fact, one of the things we do, see, is we constantly try to lower their expectations. You know, in fact, one of the key questions we ask them in the first session is, look, have you ever had an argument? A really, really severe argument. Oh, no, we love each other. Okay, jot that down, hun. Number one goal for this couple is you want to make sure they have a real live argument before they get through the premarital counseling so we can observe them how they handle it. If they don't know how to handle it, we'll teach them how to handle it because they're going to have one. See, it's going to happen sooner or later. Might as well face it, see. One of the things I like about Ed Wheat's tapes on the sexual area is at the end of that thing, one of the things he does is he says, look, the wedding night is never what it's cracked up to be. In fact, some of you may have a terrible experience on the wedding night. This business of sexual compatibility is a lifelong process of working on it. And he assures them that his sex life with his wife is better than it's ever been at age 60, I think it is. And that don't wake up the next morning, first morning on your honeymoon after the wedding, and say, what have I done? You know. The first night is the first trial, see. I mean, it's like learning a new sport. You know, he tries to say, look, don't expect the really top thing. Now, a lot of people come back to us on the evaluation. They say, man, you know, I mean, you really had us scared to death going through all that stuff, you know. And it was terrific, you know. Well, great. You know, see, if they come out with a positive attitude, you know, that's even better. See, if it's better than we painted it to be. But we try to bring them down to reality. So I think, if anything, the couples after going through the program are more alert to problems than they would be otherwise. Somebody else had their hand up. Yeah.
I've noticed that you assign them a fair bit of reading material. Yeah. What would you do if the couple, they don't find it easy to read or to absorb? Like that,
yeah. Well, we that has been a problem with a couple of the fellows in particular, and I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. We try to get them to read through it. One case, we recommended that the gal read it to her fiancé and talk about it as they read through. Some people are more eager to read than others. We had one fellow who, on this session, the one on session four on roles and responsibilities, you'll notice that there are a couple of books here by women. There's the one called The Mark of a Man by Elizabeth Elliot. And there's one creative counterpart by Linda Dillo. This is the only one we've ever had like this. But this fellow had a conviction that he should not read a book like this by a woman, lest he be taught by a woman. See? Well, you know, I felt that was unfortunate. But what we did is we recommended some alternate books. In the first session on finances, which really begins on 9:21, there is a workbook that Jack Davies has prepared where we ask the couple to go through, look up all the scriptures together, and discuss them, because some of the principles they may not agree with. For example, in that workbook on page 940, there is a thing called the 10-70-20 plan. Now, you'll find some things in the Scripture about tithing, which we talk about there, but you won't find anything about the 10-70-20 plan. All right, that is a suggestion. They may have differences of opinion on that. Okay, I mean, some of our people are really into this business of discipleship, and they would follow literally some of the things that Bill McDonald talks about in his True Discipleship. See, to get any extra savings, don't keep them, you know. Pass them on to the Lord's work, see? So they wouldn't like this idea in here on savings, okay? The idea is not to force our viewpoint down their throat, but to get them to talk about these things. Get them to communicate. Decide what they're going to do from a biblical basis. And the heart of this session is the budget on page 9.36. We usually have both the fellow and the girl prepare have them prepare two budgets, one with just the fellow's income, one with the fellow and the girl's income if they both plan to work. Because that way, if the girl's planning on working and she gets pregnant, then at least we know what the score is going to be, and with just the fellow's income. One of the reasons we do this is the second session is if they need to get out of debt before they get married, it gives them time to do it. We used to have this as one of the last sessions. Then, of course, it was too late. See? So we like to do that up front. There's also a questionnaire here. I mean, you go down this list on 937. Do these things extra desirable, useful, or necessary? Well, you know, you'll get all kinds of opinions from Christians on life insurance. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer as far as I'm concerned to some of these questions. It's a matter of conviction. Again, we're not trying to force our viewpoint. We're trying to get them to talk about these things. And all the way through, a lot of the questionnaires are to force communication about things they don't like to talk about. Now, the reason that's such a strong goal with me is one of the first couples I married was a marriage between a Pentecostal gal, she came from Pentecostal circles, and the fellow who came from the assembly was a rigid dispensationalist who felt that all tongue speaking was of the devil. Okay. Now, as you might imagine, they would not discuss that issue because they were afraid of breaking up. They were afraid of losing each other. They loved each other, even though she was possessed with a devil. And they loved each other, but they were afraid to talk about it for fear they would lose each other. See, and they figured that after they got married, then they could settle that once they were hooked. That's the wrong time to talk about that problem, see?
Would you see that as an unequal yoke?
No, we wouldn't see it as an unequal yoke. In fact, the way we approached it was we felt as the counselor that it was our job to force communication in that area. Again, not to force our convictions about that on them. But we asked some questions like, first of all, of the gal, are you willing to submit to your husband and go to church where he wants to go, even if it's not Pentecostal? Secondly, what are you going to tell your kids? We look at the man and say, are you going to teach your kids that all tongue speaking is of the devil, and then they hear your wife speaking in tongues? You know, what are you going to train your kids? What if your job transfers you to an area where the only evangelical church for miles around is a charismatic church? Would you be willing to go? See, it's not that we're saying, look, this is right, this is wrong, but look, you've got to think these things through, work them through. And they did, and they've got a beautiful marriage now. They worked all that through in advance. It was a little painful at the time, but there's never been a problem in this area. And they're one of the leading couples in our assembly. The wife never tells anybody about tongues. In fact, I don't know, maybe she's stopped now. It's just not an issue. Okay? And she has done a lot of things in ministry in the assembly, and the fellow has not been as effective in ministry as she has, but they've got a really solid marriage. Okay. There's on 944, there's an article from Reader's Digest on hidden meanings of money in marriage. We like for them to read. And then 946 begins the second session on leaving cleaving based on the Genesis 2 passage, leaving parents, cleaving to one another, becoming one flesh. There's a questionnaire here they do individually. They discuss their answers in front of the counselor. They do a session together on goals, which is question 5, and also question 5 of the premarital questionnaire. They set their goals together. They discuss those, talk about them with us. Usually 947 is really mushy, you know. It's really romantic because you've got write down 12 reasons why you want to marry your fiancé. And one guy presented a list of 100 reasons, each one of them with a scriptural reference. It's incredible. I'm just about to frame it, you know. And yeah, right. And you may want to check sheet number 948, what you need to know about my past. That has been the singularly most helpful sheet we have used in this session because
the couples have come out of this and they said, man, was this an eye-opener to know about the background, what the family life was like. Now, you may think that that's not important, but, you know, it's important from the standpoint that we asked them to share on here. Here are some things I did not like about the way my parents ran our family. I don't want that to happen in my marriage. Here are some things I do like about it. Like we had one couple recently said, the thing I loved about our family is we had some beautiful traditions. The way we observe Christmas, I want to do that in my family. The way we observe Thanksgiving, I want to do that in my family, see? So, just a real eye-opener to see where you come from on that kind of thing. There's a session on 9:49. We get into the next session on roles and responsibilities. The worksheet is based on Ephesians 5 and two books. Role concept comparison on 9:50 is another one of those questionnaires to get them to communicate. Expectations on page 952. The action items are marked with an arrow. Write 20 expectations you will have of your fiancé when you are married. We ask them to do all kinds of things. You know, like the wife will the wife will come up with an expectation. I expect my husband to be the one who always initiates prayer. Man, I didn't know you were going to expect that. You know, he said. It may be that the wife will put down something like, I expect you to take out the garbage. You know? Well, hey, now, wait a minute. My list here, I expect you to take out the garbage. My mother always took out the garbage. It's a woman's job to take out the garbage. No, it isn't. My father always took out the garbage. See? And we had a couple like that. And man, the garbage built up for weeks as they, you know, waited for each other to take out the garbage. See? Then there's a thing, 953... this is a sheet my wife put together for a couples retreat we did for another church, and it's the leadership women want. And then we did a men's session, a men's retreat, and I used her sheet. And the guy said, how come you didn't include that in the premarital counseling program? I never knew that a woman wanted to see initiation in that area, or responsibility for choosing the church, or, you know, planning ahead in this area. You know, it was an eye-opener, so we included it. The gossips then came up on 9:55 with the counterpart to that, the submission that men desire from a man's point of view. And then the last session, we've got 1 Peter 3 worksheet, 1 Corinthians 7 on 9:57, some sheets on communication, 9:58, 9:59, 9:60, 9:61. 9:62 is copyrighted. 962 through 965. This looks like a test. We don't use it as a test. It's a tremendous communication tool. You might try it with your wife. Just go home and try it with your wife. Have her fill out the female form, which asks the same questions from the female perspective, and then you fill out yours. And then take her out to dinner some night and just go down this together. That's what my wife and I did. You know, like the first question, do you and your wife discuss the manner in which the family income should be spent? And I say usually, and she puts down seldom. Now, wait a minute. Why did you put down seldom in that slot? See? Talk about that. Me and I, you know, we did this. We had been married probably, 15 years when we did this. And man, I found out a lot of things about my wife I didn't know. See? There's also one, by the way, from the same outfit that you can order for parents and teens. That is really an eye opener when we had our boys do that in terms of communication, what they expected from us. There's an article, 968, how important is sex to a happy marriage? That's from the Reader's Digest. And then 971 is the final evaluation form 6 months after the marriage. And what it does is it has them rate us. You know, we go through and we say, look, give us a rating, 1 to 10. What do you think was most helpful? Go through and tell us where we could expand, what areas we should eliminate, what we should condense. And this is where we're getting most of our feedback for change. See, the reason we, for example, chucked that book on the act of marriage is there was a couple of guy and a gal who were just saying, man, you know, I,
it was a pretty heavy trip on sex, you know, that last session. You know, I just really couldn't, I found it difficult, you know. Even though it was close to the wedding, I found it difficult. So we said, okay, you know, let's think about that. Pray about that. So we eliminated something. And that's what we're trying to do as we upgrade along the line. Okay, any comments or questions? Yeah. I'm surprised nobody's asked me the question, do you marry divorced people? That was next, right? Yeah, that's always the question. I apologize. I meant to include in the notes the elder's position paper on marriage and divorce and remarriage, which we hammered out together in the scriptures. And I meant that to put that in, not to try and force that on you, but to simply show you what we had done as an assembly. I think the reason it's not in here is we're having trouble keeping them reproduced fast enough. We put them in the rack and they're gone as soon as we put them in. Seems like everybody in our fellowship is sending them to their brother and cousin and Aunt Tizzy and everybody all over the country. But our position is that there are, first of all, two grounds for divorce. There is adultery and there is the desertion by an unbeliever in 1 Corinthians 7. We believe the 1 Corinthians 7 passage teaches that if that happens, the unbeliever departs and deserts, that the believer is free to remarry. We believe that's part of that, the meaning of that word, to be free. Okay, so we will remarry people that have, where they've been the unfortunate victims of a divorce, either on biblical grounds. We don't encourage them to go ahead with a divorce, even though there has been adultery. We say, look, the better option is forgiveness and reconciliation. But if that's happened and you feel there must be a divorce, you have biblical grounds, and if that happens, we do remarry. And we have had older couples where that's happened. We have one fellow that, boy, I really admire the guy. He hung in with his unbelieving wife who did everything under the sun. She had all kinds of affairs and everything. He hung in with her for about 15 years. And finally said, you know, my wife is not even at home anymore. And I've done everything I can to witness to her, to lead her to the Lord, to do everything possible. And I'm just at my wit's end, and I'm wondering what you think. Can I get a divorce? We said, well, you've certainly got biblical grounds. So he got a divorce, and later on he met this gal that he was married. So he was an older couple. We took them right through the same program. Now, it is true that if you get an older couple and they feel like, well, you know, we really don't want to go through this premarital counseling thing. We had one older couple in our assembly that went elsewhere to get married, you know, I think to avoid the premarital counseling program. But that's not very common. Most people actually want to go through it. Okay, well, I think we're at the one last question.
If you have counseling with your couple,
well, if they have no biblical grounds for divorce, you see, we would certainly not be very accepting to them. You know, if they've been resistant to our counsel and so forth, that happened on the one we lost, see? Because there was no biblical grounds for divorce, but the wife went ahead and filed for divorce. There's no way that we could, tolerate that situation with her in full fellowship having gone through that, see? Now, she made it easy for us because she left before it ever got to the point of excommunicating her, you know, for doing that. The fellow wanted that marriage to hold together, and he's still in full fellowship. See, and because that she is now remarried, if that fellow came to us today and said, I want to be remarried, we would feel that we would have biblical grounds to perform that marriage. Although, in his particular case, we'd probably counsel him that there are going to be a number of problems related to the kind of thing you saw in your last marriage. Okay, I think we better call it off. Do you have other questions? Feel free to approach me privately. Father, we thank you for this time we've had, and we thank you for the interest these men have shown in practicing premarital counseling and preparing our young people and others for marriage. We pray that marriages in our assemblies will be a testimony
to the picture you have provided of Christ's love for His church. And we pray that we'll be a witness to that in our own marriages, and that we will be examples to the flock of strong marriages. In Christ's name, amen.